Let's get started today. Welcome everybody to our latest Employment Law 101. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment Law and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England, but we work with companies that are all over the UK and indeed across the world, actually, that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK. And that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning on this beautiful sunny day.
It's fantastic, isn't it? It's so good. Couple of housekeeping points. As always, this session is being recorded, so you'll be able to see the video recording on our website next week at some point. Audio recording will be available on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts now, and also on Spotify. So check out our recordings there. We've got something like 60 back issues now. So go and have a look on Spotify. You just need to search Employment Law 101. Chat function, it might be disabled, but I'll enable it if it is disabled. So feel free to put some messages in the chat if you want to correspond with anybody else that's joining today. Q&As, we love questions. Please do fire off your questions to us. We might deal with them as we go along. We might just save them up to the end. Just use the Q&A function at the bottom, which somebody has done to say she's getting MPM Legal emails on two email addresses
Let's
with the
sort it
information.
out.
Oh, we'll have a look at that. Just drop me a line, Victoria, if you've got my email address. Send me an example of what you're getting. Okay. What are we talking about today? Neurodiversity in the workplace. Just so happens that this week is Neurodiversity Celebration Week. Now, that's a worldwide initiative that challenges stereotypes and misconceptions about neurological differences. Given that, and the publication recently of some ACAS material on neurodiversity, we thought today's session was really ripe for a discussion on neurodiversity in the workplace. Also, not least, because in terms of our day-to-day practice, we've seen a real spike in workplace issues relating to neurodiversity. And I think, Adrienne, it's fair to say that was really noticeable kind of from COVID onwards, I would say.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the reason is. I mean, there's no doubt that we're seeing significant increase in neurodiverse people coming forward. And you know, whether that's because people are becoming braver in speaking out because it's more acceptable, there's been more discussion around it, whether the medical profession has kind of developed in this area, I just don't know. But it's a fact that I think workplaces are going to have to catch up and have to adjust their mindsets to harness the good that can come out of this. I mean, there's always a lot of discussions around different ways that people think being a force for good within organizations in terms of things like creativity, etc. I mean, I think I probably would say is that as employment lawyers, we probably see the more sticky end of sort of disability related claims and neurodiversity, but there's certainly a lot of very good positive stories out there. But I wanted to start off, I think, with just some statistics. So apologies if this makes you yawn. This might be the time when you have a slurp of your cup of tea, but I know Peter's shaking his head because he loves some statistics, don't you? But they're saying approximately around 15 to 20% of the UK population is estimated to be neurodivergent. I mean, how they test that, I don't know, but it does equate to around 13 million people. And according to local government associations, one in seven people in the UK are neurodivergent. In employment, the Office for National Statistics, as of December 2020, so you know that seems like yesterday, but it is over 4 years old. 22% of autistic people aged 16 to 64 are in employment. And according to the National Autistic Society, only around 3 in 10 working age autistic people are in employment. And that's compared with around 5 in 10 for all disabled people and 8 in 10 for non-disabled people. So those figures do not make good reading, I think. Only 1 in 10 organisations have been focusing on neurodiversity at work. And again, how those stats are pulled together, I don't know where it is, but those are the ones that are sort of publicising it and have been recorded. And according to the CIPD, 1 in 5 neurodivergent employees has experienced harassment or discrimination at work because of the neurodivergence. According to the CIPD, and I think this is quite shocking, 51% of neurodivergent professionals have quit or want to quit their jobs because they say they lack support from their managers. And I think it's a big area of growth and the need for increased understanding. Wouldn't you agree? Slurp of your tea.
Yeah, you asked that question at a really inopportune moment. Yeah,
Sorry.
absolutely, absolutely. I mean, while you were talking about those, I was thinking as well, what we've got to throw into the mix are the newly announced PIP changes that Labour are saying they're going to make. Because I think if we talk about, disabilities more generally as well, we've got to expect that there's going to be this government drive to push more people who may have a disability into the workplace. And there are some big question marks around exactly how that's going to help. And certainly from, the employer community and representative bodies, there are going to be legitimate questions around what support businesses and organizations are going to have to enable them to be best equipped to support people with disabilities. And we know that kind of goes right through the employment relationship, don't we?
Absolutely. One of the things, just sort of chopping in there, it reminds me of like many years ago when there was this big shift in looking at somebody from an age perspective. Do you remember when it used to be a case of once you're 50, that's it, it's really difficult to find a job? And there was a big shift in mindset. And I remember B&Q in particular proudly advertising that they would take on older staff. So, whether it's that kind of shift in mindset that's going forward, I mean, you'd like to think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's really noticeable with B&Q as well, actually. I was in there about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and you can see that. I think they made a point of attracting certain age people, maybe people who wanted to work on a part-time basis as well, and I think that's still
But
there
with a
today.
massive skill
So
set and years of
yeah,
experience,
absolutely,
ability to bring
absolutely,
something to the party.
absolutely. So in terms of the language that we're using when we're talking about neurodiversity, obviously that language does change over time. When we're using the term neurodivergent, we're using that to describe someone whose brain works differently to what's considered to be typical. And we'll also use the terms neurodivergence and neuroinclusive as well. And again, this is something that ACAS mandate as best practice. And I know most of you will be familiar with ACAS, but for those of you that aren't, ACAS, a statutory body, they set the kind of blue ribbon standard in terms of employee relations generally. They've got a wealth of resources available on their website. And I always encourage people to check that out as a starting point with any issues. Their policy is to try to use identity first language. So an example of that is describing somebody as being autistic, as an example, and not ha somebody has autism. And that's because a lot of people see neurodivergence as part of who they are and not something that they have. Okay. Now, I've mentioned ACAS produced some really, really helpful material. And what I want to do is just walk through some of the common neurodiversity aspects that we see manifest in the workplace, just so we're kind of all on the same page in terms of things that we typically see. So first, ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, sometimes affects somebody's behavior. Somebody who has ADHD may refer to themselves as an ADHDer. I've heard that before. And somebody with ADHD might find it difficult to concentrate on certain tasks. They may struggle with time management and organization, may have trouble following instructions, but equally may have time when they're absolutely hyper-focused and entirely focused on a task. They could be particularly good at creative thinking and have lots of energy. And one of the examples that ACAS provide is somebody called Lou, who's a bus driver, has ADHD, finds printing out their daily itinerary improves timekeeping and focus, but they find it difficult to concentrate in team briefings. But to cope with that, they take notes and they find it easier when people speak clearly. One of Lou's strengths is memorizing different routes, which means they're very efficient when driving through rush hour traffic or diversions. Second one is autism, and autism affects how people communicate and interact, and it's sometimes referred to as a spectrum condition. And someone who's autistic might take things literally. They may react differently to senses like sound and smell, may be anxious about social situations, might have difficulty interpreting social cues, might seem rude without meaning to. May have very, very good attention to detail, be excellent at problem solving and creative thinking also, and have really good memory. And the example that ACAS provide is Sasha, who's autistic and works in a bar. She can get overwhelmed when it's very loud and busy in the bar. And so when this happens, she uses noise reducing earplugs and focuses on tasks like glass washing and restocking fridges. Sasha's passionate about the preparation and stock control tasks that most staff find boring, and it makes her popular with other employees. Dyslexia, Probably more well known, affects reading and writing skills, affects how someone processes information more generally. So somebody who's dyslexic might have difficulties concentrating or listening, may read or write slowly, forget things easily, but be really, really good at problem solving and thinking creatively, and also have strong verbal communication skills as well. And then we also have dyspraxia. So dyspraxia is something which affects movement and coordination, and it's sometimes called developmental coordination disorder. Now, someone who's dyspraxic might have poor balance. They may have difficulties pronouncing some words. They may take longer to do some tasks, but also have really strong verbal communication skills and also be really, really good at creative thinking. And again, the example that ACAS provide is somebody called Jazz, who's dyspraxic. They work best by talking things through, but they find it overwhelming to have lots of meetings in one day. They agree with their manager to block out time each week where people cannot book meetings, and that gives them time to focus on those tasks that they find more difficult. So they're examples that ACAS provide, and I think it's just quite useful to see what the common traits, if you like, are associating with those aspects of neurodiversity as well. What about neurodiversity in the workplace context, though, Adrienne, in particular, in relation to this question of disability?
Yeah, no, it's quite interesting. When I read the ACAS guidance, and I did find it really helpful. I mean, it's an enormous topic, but I think it's really important to remember that a lot of neurodivergent people will not see themselves as disabled, but being neurodivergent will often amount to a disability under the Equality Act when it comes to handling, workplace issues such as conduct and such performance. But it's also equally important to remember that it won't always be a disability. It won't always be covered. So just because somebody is autistic or an ADHDer, as you put it, doesn't necessarily mean that they will be disabled. Because the problem with this is that it's a very fact-based test, and it takes into account things like how a health condition impacts on the employee's ability to do their normal day-to-day activities. But ultimately, legally, whether somebody is covered and is disabled or not is a decision that's made by an employment tribunal judge based on all the facts. If an employee is covered under the Equality Act, it means they have a right not to be discriminated against because of a disability. And the big one is the right to have reasonable adjustments made, remembering, and this is a bit that everyone forgets, is that the adjustments are there to make the employee or to help them be successful in their role. So, I mean, I think there's a whole load of stuff there. But I mean, one of the things that I picked out from the ACAS guidance, and this is something that comes up quite a lot with some of our clients, is the ACAS guidance notes that a formal diagnosis is not necessarily always needed.
That's an important point,
You
that,
know,
isn't it?
we get clients go, but we ask this, but they say they've got an employee who's not performing. They come to them and they say, oh, I've got ADHD. We ask them, for their assessment report, and they say they're awaiting a formal diagnosis. Now, I know that waiting for an assessment is just an incredibly long process unless you're prepared to pay privately for it. I think the
Like
NHS.
years, maybe.
I think it's about 3.5 years is the current waiting list to get somebody assessed. So look, from an employer's point of view, it's just not realistic to say, well, until you've got an assessment, we're not going to accept it, because you've got an employee in the workplace already that is maybe struggling, or that you want to manage, or you want to help. So what do you do in the meantime? And so I think that coming back to sort of like the legal tests when it comes to disability discrimination, one of the key points in any tribunal case for discrimination is whether or not it's accepted by the employer that the employee is disabled. And very often, the first port of call will be for the judge to set a preliminary hearing at which, the judge will say to the employer, do you accept they're disabled? And if not, why not? That then kicks off a whole assessment process, which will involve a joint medical report, where you both parties have to agree on a medical expert to assess the employee. It's usually paid for by the respondent, and the claimant has to submit an impact statement. Now, that's a statement where they set out essentially how their condition affects their day-to-day life and how they can, how it makes things more difficult, etc., all of the stuff. That then goes before the judge. And the judge decides, yes, the employee is disabled, or no, they're not. And then the case progresses from there. So I think on a practical level, and I'm not a fan of employment tribunals, I do my best to keep my clients out of them. But my question's this: do you want to wait until this stage, or might it not be better to have the conversation with the employee in the first place to explore reasonable adjustments? Let's not sort of get into whether or not they're disabled or not. If they're struggling, the natural thing, in my view, would be to sit down and say, "Well, okay, how can we help?" Now, it's obviously quite a big topic, and the term reasonable adjustments has kind of been built up into something which may be something really critical, but could just be, right, what can we do to support this employee where we've spent money hiring them, we've invested time in them, we're having one-to-ones with them, which is set out. One-to-one should be to try and A, praise them for the stuff that they do well, and B, explore where they're struggling. So if they are struggling, what adjustments can be put in place to help them be successful? It can be, it can be anything from noise cancelling headphones to helping them with diary management, etc. And then if you're looking at it this way, then you are already in that position where, even if it's not accepted that they're disabled, you have put in place steps to help them. Now, if the adjustments that the employee comes up with, and you should talk to the employee about them. You might also want to get occupational health for some support. If the adjustments aren't reasonable and can't be done, then you're not going to have breached your duty. You'll have been able to explore them because, some people ask for some stuff that is really just not possible.
We just had
But
a question on that actually, Adrian. It's a
okay.
good moment. Someone's asked, when does reasonable cease to be reasonable regarding adjustments? And it's something we get asked a lot, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, oh God, I'm going to have to try and think of an example off the top of my head. But the first thing I would say is the coming back to where the ultimate decisions are made. The ultimate decisions are made in an employment tribunal, and one of the key phrases is it depends on the size and resources of your employer. So if you're a decent sized employer, you're likely to have to go that extra mile to try and help them. I mean, there's things like access to work. If they're being asked for equipment, then you would be having to look for it. Where it doesn't become reasonable is where there's big infrastructure costs, etc., which would not be reasonable. But there might be changes to their hours. I mean, I know I'm going to open a can of worms when I say this, but it might be remote working, it might be hybrid working. This type of stuff would be something that needs to come into scope when you're talking about adjustments.
There's a non-exhaustive list of reasonable adjustments. And I think the point that I would make as well is that what's reasonable for you as a business to make in respect of one particular individual and the role they do is not necessarily a reasonable adjustment for you to make with regard to another individual, if there are differentiating factors. So it's ultimately what's reasonable in the circumstances for you to make. And it is a potential battleground. You do see disputes over an employee saying it's reasonable for you to do this thing, and the employer saying, no, it's not reasonable for us to do it for these reasons. If an employment tribunal agrees with you, there isn't going to be a breach. You're going to be okay. But you've got to take a common sense approach. And I think a lot of this stuff is fairly easy and low cost to implement, actually, when you drill down into it. It might be giving someone extra time, might be changing the way that you do things, just moving away from how you've always done things to, I don't know, providing meeting agendas written down in advance, for example, rather than running on an ad hoc basis. If people are interested in reading up more on reasonable adjustments, though, I'll just point you to the Equality and Human Rights Commission Code of Practice. It's a free resource. It's probably about 250 pages long, maybe longer, actually. But within that document, there are loads and loads of examples of what constitutes good, reasonable adjustments with practical examples.
Yeah, I just want to pick up on a question that somebody's raised. Is we talk about reasonable adjustments, it's so variable. Some ASDs don't know what can help. How can we adjust the approach if they're struggling and we need to support them? I think, yeah, I totally agree. But I think a lot of people see the right, we'll have a conversation, we'll put the reasonable adjustments in place, and bingo, it should work. Whereas in actual fact, I think it's a two-way dialogue where very often you go, okay, so why don't we try this? Let's see how that works. Why don't we try this? And it can be a bit of an ongoing process. It might be that, let's put some diary management in place. Let's give you a quiet space to concentrate. Let's encourage you to switch off your emails while you focus on that one task, so that when things ping into your inbox, you don't get distracted. And I'm speaking from personal experience there, where I get horribly distracted by emails popping in. And I think it's just it's working together, the manager and the employee, to try and to try things. It doesn't have to be a big thing, but let's try things, see if they work, and see if and see if see what's working well for them. But unless you're going to have that open dialogue with the employee, I think it's extremely difficult. And that's what I mean about that change of mindset. It's like, right, this is the role that we've hired you for. This is what you've got the skills for. Let's help you be successful. Now, sometimes it can be that that role, I mean, and I've had this before with another client, that somebody is simply not right for that role. But it's about taking them on the journey so that they can understand that, with the discussion around reasonable adjustments, and then, of course, looking to see if there's something else that might actually suit their creativity, etc., better than the role they think they should be doing. Can I just move on very quickly to this note on knowledge? Because this is something that comes up quite a lot on ours. And a client will dismiss an employee, and then they'll be like, well, how on earth are we facing a claim? Because only at that point will the employee come forward and go, the dismissal was discriminatory because I am autistic. And the employer has never been told, has never been provided with any information by the employee. Legally, if you don't know, and here's the additional bit, if you haven't been told by the employee, or it is not reasonable that you could have known, then you can't discriminate against somebody. But I think that whole thing about not reasonably knowing about the disability is something else that the ACAS guide covers. And it talks about masking. And a lot of neurodivergent employees will mask their condition at work, and they'll hide it so that they can fit in better. They might be embarrassed, or frankly, they don't want to raise it because they automatically think that they'll be named a problem child as a result. And, I think that's really, really commonplace. But masking can cause all kinds of things. Mental health problems. It can make someone feel exhausted, very isolated, that they can't be true to themselves in the workplace. So but it's really, really difficult. So, how can an employer say, well, I couldn't reasonably have known? Because we don't have medical training. We don't know whether or not somebody's neurodiverse or not. But I suppose it would just come back to what I was saying about that two-way dialogue about what can be done to support an employee being successful, be alive to the difficulties, think about having those conversations, such as, you seem to be struggling with this time management here. So how can we help? What can we put in place to address that? Now, that might mean that the employee is going to be braver and can step forward and go, yeah, do you know what? I've always struggled with time management. I think I might be ADHD. I'm going through an assessment. And then they've come out with that information. But even if they don't, you're still making those adjustments, and you're still providing that support, because you're putting in place something to help them get the job done. And we kind of talked about adjustments in the recruitment process itself last session, didn't we? But yeah, I mean, look, the ACAS guidance does go on to give other examples of how issues can arise in the workplace. It gives an example of somebody's policy, and this was interesting because this was very, very close to a case last year. So just to kind of quickly run through the example. The ACAS guidance sets out this one. Sam's disciplined for quoting offensive terms during an equality training session. And for those of you that have attended our sessions, you may well have remembered we did a session on this. The employer has a zero tolerance policy for this type of behaviour. Sam's dyslexic and says they didn't mean to offend anybody. Their dyslexia can cause them to lose their train of thought when focusing on complex questions, and this leads them to say things impulsively. Sam's employer is aware that Sam is dyslexic, But having a policy that stopped them from taking this into account, the zero tolerance, is likely to be disability discrimination. So that's one example of it coming up in the workplace. I talked about knowledge and assuming or trying to work out whether somebody's neurodivergent without the medical training. But it's a kind of bit of a double-edged sword there, because assuming somebody is neurodivergent is also tricky. Receiving unwanted comments is an example that ACAS guidance gives, where someone incorrectly thinks that they're neurodivergent. This can be a type of disability discrimination called discrimination by perception. So it is difficult. Then, of course, you've got sort of exclusion, bullying issues. That's not necessarily classed as discrimination, but still could cause legal issues such as constructive dismissal. And the example given by ACAS is Mo, who is autistic, and has shared this with people at work. Mo finds wearing headphones helps them focus and avoid sensory overload. Mo struggles to keep eye contact when talking to people. Other employees make comments that Mo is weird and rude. And they exclude Mo from work social events. This is likely to be disability discrimination. So lots of things to consider.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But we have good news, which is we've got some practical tips in terms of what you can do as organizations to try and avoid any legal liability. But it's more than that, actually. If you can aim to be neuro-inclusive, there are much wider benefits other than simply reducing legal risk, which is obviously something that factors high on our list as employment lawyers, but we totally recognise there are wider benefits for doing it, and those are things like better well-being for your employees. You'll have lower absence levels. You'll have a lower employee turnover. You'll no doubt attract a wider range of skills into your business as well. And if you're better supporting your employees, and this is employees across the board, of course, but they're more likely to be performing at the best. So good productivity, good for business. So in terms of sort of some simple practical steps to take, you start off, I think, by reviewing your recruitment processes. Now, actually, we covered recruitment in our last session 2 weeks ago. So the recording of that is, yes, on our website at the moment. So we talked about reasonable adjustments. We talked about avoiding disability discrimination in recruitment. So it was quite a focused session. There are a lot of simple and low-cost changes you can make to recruitment processes. One very quick example: making sure the job description and person specifications you're coming up with match exactly what you are actually recruiting for, not including anything that's superfluous, which is quite an easy mistake to make, actually. Also, I've mentioned it before, the Equality and Human Rights Commission Code of Practice, they have a very dedicated section in respect of recruitment as well. So loads of practical examples in there. So start at the beginning, look at your recruitment processes. Tied in with that is training and supporting managers. So that could be training and supporting individuals who have got primary responsibility on the recruitment side, but also those managers who are involved in recruitment exercises as well. One point. The other point, just general training and support of managers anyway. We know it's really challenging sometimes to manage a team and to manage a team with different needs as well. So how are you going to make sure your managers have got the skills to do that and get the best out of everybody? There are a few things to think about there, I think. So training on reasonable adjustments and discrimination, collaboration across managers to share experience and best practice, although the watch out there is not to be sharing anything they've agreed with an employee to keep confidential, of course. We're talking about sensitive personal data. Giving your managers access to HR resource and support, and also occupational health as well, so they know where to signpost people. Encouraging that communication. I mean, a lot of employment relations matters we deal with do boil down to poor communication, and better communication between managers and employees, whether it's formal one-to-one meetings or just informal catch-ups, they're golden opportunities for issues to come out and be discussed in a way before you get to the point where a grievance has landed on somebody's desk and an issue has been escalated. And also monitoring adjustments for effectiveness as well. Adrian's talked about reasonable adjustments and how they operate, how the duty might apply. Yes, you can put them in, but are they actually effective? It's easy to make something and then just forget about it. No one's looking at it. You fast forward 12 months, it hasn't really moved the dial at all for the individual. So do some monitoring of it. Is it working? Great, carry on. Does it need tweaking or modifying some way if it's not working? The other area we see kind of employee relations stuff that comes across our desks in relation to changes of management as well, isn't it, Adrienne? So they have a new manager come in, and I think that translates into non-disability related issues and performance management issues generally. That'll be familiar to a lot of you. But with regard to individuals who may be disabled in changing managers, that can be a problem area too, can't it?
Yeah, and I think, but I, like you said, I think that applies generally across the workforce. I mean, but quite a few issues come up when there is a change of manager. There might be a different change of style, etc. Or one manager, frankly, that was outgoing may not have been as hot on performance management as the new manager. But again, ACAS guidance suggests that the if there are adjustments in place, that they are properly documented, and that's where HR can come in to help. But also that there is sort of like a proper handover, and if reasonable adjustments have been put in place, then the employee sits down with the old manager and the new manager to talk through what how it works, what's in place, etc., so that that there is sort of like a bit of a seamless transition, at least. I mean, look, this is all in an ideal world, and we know things do go wrong, but at least if you're trying to do this type of stuff, it's going to help going forward. Can I just cut in there, because I just wanted to address a couple of the comments here, because I think this is really important, and again, it's reflected in the ACAS guidance. One of the questions: if after we've made adjustments, but the person is still underperforming, what extent do we prove adjustments versus poor performance? The ACAS guidance specifically says that if you put the adjustments in place in agreement with the employee and they are still not performing, then you manage them. You manage them in the same way that you would manage any other underperforming employee, because it's not that you can't touch them. But the conversation would probably go something like, we agreed these adjustments, didn't we? You said this would help with the condition. We've monitored it. We've talked about it for a while. It's still not working out. So why is that? And that way, you get the situation where somebody can ha say, well, I now need to manage your performance because we've done what we think we needed to do in conjunction with you to make you successful in your job, and it still isn't working out. And I think I think that's really important to remember, that the reasonable adjustments piece is to level the playing field. So at that point, you are able to manage the employees in the same way as you would anybody else, of course, making sure that you make adjustments for the actual process itself. So I kind of just wanted to jump in there and add that.
No, it's valid. So it is a concern for people. It feeds back to this issue around adjustments generally. In terms of some of the other practical points, take away then, fourthly, just raising awareness of neurodiversity across the organisation. We're obviously tuned into it. You're tuned into it, which is why you're joining us today to talk about it. But it's just getting it running like a thread through your organization, so there's greater awareness. So ways to do that, you can include it as part of mandatory training or an induction process. And really what that helps with is baking it in. It shows that you're inclusive to that individual from day one of their employment with you. And I'm not talking about they as being a disabled person. I'm talking about a new joiner to your organization. It provides a supportive environment, but also it doesn't have to be complicated. You can refer to what we've been talking about today along with other DEI training that you may be implementing or that you have as part of your onboarding process. Things like awareness days we've seen clients implement. So there's been a lot of noise on well, noise is the wrong word. There's been a lot of informative information actually on LinkedIn this week about Neurodiversity Celebration Week, which has been fantastic to see. And no doubt some of the organizations you're representing today may be getting involved in that as well, which is fantastic. What about having senior staff as role models? If you've got somebody senior within your organization who's open about being neurodivergent, that can really help promote that inclusive culture. And it's also reassuring for junior employees as well. It shows that career pathway. It shows that these things don't have to be a barrier at all to having a really, fulfilling, effective career. And then another point, which I know for sure that a couple of our clients implement as well, is having a staff network. Now, obviously, you need to have an organization that is large enough to sustain the numbers, I suggest. So, if there's like two, three, four of you in a business, it's not going to work. But for those of you that are into the hundreds of employees and into the thousands, staff networks can be a really effective way of bringing people together as well. Also consider support for all employees. A lot of the adjustments and things on a practical level you can look to implement will work for everybody. So, private quiet workplaces, or a dedicated workspace that anyone can use, that will help everybody, but it also helps those who may not want to share their neurodivergence as well. Okay, finally, a neurodiversity policy is a good idea. It could be a standalone policy, or you might fold it into part of another policy as well. But having a section that talks about neurodiversity, I think, is particularly valuable. In that policy, the sort of things you might want to look at, what your organization's commitment is to neurodiversity, an acknowledgement of what your legal responsibilities are, what support is available, and a description of how your processes are neuro-inclusive. So that could be with regard to promotion opportunities, internal movement across the business. Could also just feed into what your recruitment and hiring processes are as well, and what support is available. ACAS advice on this, which I think is a good rule for anything you ever produce for employees anyway, is use clear language and not jargon. Break down information with headings. Use short sentences and paragraphs. So just keep it simple, really. And of course, we at MPM have a policy if you're in need of one. So if that interests you, then get in touch.
Okay, I think we've run over a little bit, and really appreciate the input that we've had from everybody today. Some really interesting comments that have come out. So we hope you've enjoyed today's session. And as always, if you've got any questions, just drop us a line or connect with us on LinkedIn.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said before, all the recordings are available. It's great to have so many of you joining these sessions now as well. It's fantastic. You know they're free to join. So if you are in contact with anybody that you think might be interested in joining for these webinars, please do spread the word. It really helps us out. And yeah, we love to welcome as many of you as possible. In the meantime, we are going to be back in 2 weeks' time. Topic to be determined, but I'll send an update to the Zoom invite out so you'll see what it is in advance. As always, recordings available on our website, Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts as well. So look out for those. Otherwise, thanks for joining us today and enjoy the sunshine. See you in a couple of weeks' time.